Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. President Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy met yesterday to work on a deal to raise the debt ceiling and avoid a first-ever default on the nation's debt. House Republicans have said they want to cut government spending in exchange for upping the so-called debt ceiling, a now familiar political football for the GOP. We're talking national politics. Joining us is political journalist Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. You can find a link to his work at WOSU.org/allsides. Welcome back, Ken.
Thank you, Ann. Good morning.
So they met face to face.
Yeah, and they lived to tell the tale. Well, you know something? So much of this is politics. We're talking about raising the debt ceiling here. Mm-hmm. We're talking about Kevin McCarthy, the Speaker of the House, and President Biden. And, you know, it's interesting. It seems like the Republicans only care about raising the debt ceiling or make it a big issue when there's a Democrat in the White House. Remember when President Trump was in the White House, there were three votes that raised the debt ceiling, and Democrats didn't say, woe is me, you know, henny penny, the sky is falling. They went along with it. But it just seems like the Republicans only get exercised about the debt and the government spending when the Democrats are in power.
You know, what do you make of this latest round of brinksmanship around the debt limit? The Democrats have said no way are they going to deal when it comes to entitlement. I shouldn't call them entitlement programs, but in, you know, it's things like Medicare, Social Security. Those, they're just not going to budge.
Well, certainly on Medicare and Social Security, I think both parties may be in agreement that that's not going to be touched. Former President Trump, in one of his rare policy announcements, said the other day that no, the Republicans should not touch that at all. But there are a lot of Republicans, such as Matt Gaetz of Florida, saying that, well, maybe we should touch housing and urban development. Maybe we should touch health and human services. Maybe we touch Medicaid. Mm-hmm. So the Republicans are not avoiding touching these kind of programs that could give them political headaches. But for the most part, Biden seems very confident. Remember back in 2011, when there was a battle over the debt ceiling, then was he majority leader? I guess, I don't know if he was majority leader. No, not yet. But Mitch McConnell mm-hmm. met with Vice President Biden and they worked out a deal, and Biden did make concessions. But right now, I don't think the Democrats feel they need to make concessions. I think they feel politically it's, you know, they have the upper hand. But we go through this all the time. Yeah. You know, we're always going to reach the edge of the cliff. And, oh, my goodness, are we going to default on our debts, which, of course, has never happened. And, you know, we have now until June. So you're going to see a lot of political posturing until then. And then ultimately, they'll say, lo and behold, OK, we'll vote to, increase our borrowing.
The raising the debt ceiling does not authorize new spending, just to be clear. It just says the government has to keep paying its bills.
Well, see, that's exactly it. I mean, look, I mean, yes, do we spending a lot? I think we raised, was it $9 billion or trillion dollars for corona, you know, for coronavirus? I mean, mm-hmm. that was $5 trillion, right, to fight the pandemic. And that was money that was not expected. But I mean, are we not going to pay that bill? Are we not going to pay what we have promised to do? So, again, it makes a lot of good posturing on Fox News and OAN and things like that. But ultimately, it's what we promised that we would pay. And you know, for all the posturing, it's almost unlikely. It's definitely unlikely. Now, could you say definitely unlikely in the same sentence?
It's definitely unlikely. Yeah.
Yeah, it's unlikely, right, that they're going to refuse to raise that limit.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking national politics with political journalist Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. Questions or comments for Ken, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. It's But the default, all right, there's never been a default, but we know we get a lot of scary scenarios fed to us about this time every few years when the Republicans are in control of the House, at least, about what would happen if we went into default. Our credit rating would go down. There's just a lot of problems associated with that.
Yeah, no, and those arguments have been made every time. Every time we get to this point, we say, you know, it's going to hurt our credit ratings around the world. Our money will not be worth the same because, you know, being less confidence in the economy. But ultimately, I mean, we just do this all the time. And then suddenly they vote for it and there's grumbling and then we go along. It's like the State of the Union address, which is coming up on Tuesday. I mean, everybody says, oh, my God, what is the president going to say during the State of the Union address? How is the other party going to respond? How many people remember last year's State of the Union address, let alone any State of the Union
address? Remember he got heckled. I do remember that.
Well, yes, Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert, I think, heckled President Biden. But remember, Marjorie Taylor Greene is now the adult in the room. God help me, but I don't know how that's happened. But now that she's, Speaker McCarthy's best bud, she's talking very, like, responsibly, and it's pretty remarkable. I mean, the guy she's been traveling with around the country the last couple of years, Matt Gaetz, they were on opposite sides in the Speaker McCarthy speaker battle. And so look, she knows it's amazing that she is now quoted whenever there's an issue in Congress, Marjorie Taylor Greene said, and to me, that's beyond belief, but that's what happens. I mean, you know, if we start quoting George Santos, then you know we're in trouble. But right now, Marjorie Taylor Greene was a bomb thrower, had been a bomb thrower that nobody really took seriously. And now she's part of the power and she's part of the leadership in some ways in Congress. I mean, look at who Kevin McCarthy's put on the House oversight committees to look into corruption. I mean, a lot of the people who've been investigated for January 6th are on the committee.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, you can't make this stuff up.
In his effort to get the speakership, Kevin McCarthy committed to tying those spending cuts to raising the debt ceiling. He also agreed to a House rules change, making it easier for members to oust him as speaker. What's your sense about these first few weeks on the job and how he's holding up?
Well, you know, something we'll see. I mean, well, of course, well, I'm very interested to see how Republicans react to if it is a concession or a capitulation by McCarthy with the debt limit. And they say, well, we promised. But he's a lot of us feel that he sold his soul to become speaker. I mean, as you say, now it's only one member to raise objections and to call for another vote. For speaker, as I said, he's pointed a lot of the January 6th true believers to some of the more important committees. Marjorie Taylor Greene, as I said, is a very close confidant of Kevin McCarthy. I mean, and matter of fact, yesterday, I forgot who it was. I think somebody from Axios or Politico or somebody photographed Kevin McCarthy having dinner with Kyrsten Sinema, the independent senator from Arizona, at some hideaway. And so I said, oh my goodness. I mean, you know, there are so many interesting alliances here that you would never have expected a while ago, but that's the way Washington works or doesn't work.
She's independent, but she still is technically caucusing with the Democrats, right?
She's technically caucusing with the Democrats, but she's not technically voting with the Democrats because she, and to a lesser extent, Joe Manchin of West Virginia, both of them have done whatever they could basically to disrupt or unend or, you know, the Biden's agenda for much of the first 2 years. Now, yesterday, Joe Manchin said he's not convinced he's going to run again. He's not sure if he's going to run again. And so, you know, there are a lot of uncertainties going on here. But I mean, but Kyrsten Sinema, my goodness, first of all, there's already a challenge from the Democratic mainstream or the left-wing mainstream of the Arizona Democratic Party, Ruben Gallego, the congressman, he's already announced his candidacy. And Kerry Lake, everybody's favorite election denier, is seriously considering running for the Senate. You know, if she's going to deny losing the governor's race, she might as well deny losing the Senate race as well, because that's what a lot of these Republicans do. So it's, you know, wild, it's wild, wacky stuff, as an impersonator of Johnny Carson once said.
So, all right. I'm kind of curious about Sinema, and, you know, where, if she's caucusing with the Democrats and having
dinner
with Kevin McCarthy.
She's having dinner with Kevin McCarthy. She has not announced whether she's running for re-election again. Of course, running, first of all, the thing about her becoming an independent is that she could now no longer lose a Democratic primary, which she would have done in Arizona, because that Democrats hate her guts there. I don't know if Republicans like her either, but if she stays in the race, and if she runs and there's a Democrat running, one might think that a Republican could win that seat because of a split Democratic opposition. So whether she means to or not, she's still playing a major, major role in the dynamics of Senate politics.
And what about Joe Manchin? What is he, disenchanted with politics after all this time? Or,
well, you know something, he's always prided himself of being an independent. Remember, once upon a time, West Virginia was the most Democratic state in the country. And now, I think next to Wyoming, it's Trump's best state, both in 2016 and 2020. And that's remarkable. So Joe Manchin, who used to be governor, a very popular governor, became senator shortly after Robert Byrd died. And, you know, he's won re-election, but it's been close because the state has been a solid Republican state. And even if he does run again, and we're not sure if he does, Jim Justice, the governor who was first elected as a Democrat, is now a Republican. He's talking about running. Alex Mooney, who's a congressman, has already announced his bid. So even though he is an independent, even though he has given Joe Biden such heartache, Republicans are out to beat Joe Manchin. And they'll certainly win the seat if Manchin doesn't run. And they could still win it if he does run.
I mean, Robert Byrd was no moderate Democrat. He was pretty conservative himself.
No, you know, I mean, of course, everybody remembers he was a member of the Klan before he came to Congress in 52. And, you know, he was pretty much, look, he was also, he beat Ted Kennedy for Democratic whip in 1969. So the Democrats are not prone to electing a conservative. But he was a moderate. What he really was an institutionalist. Mm-hmm. Like, he really believed in, like, we don't get rid of the filibuster, things like that, because that's the way the Senate should act. And but, you know, look, I mean, yes, he voted against Clarence
Thomas.
Marshall.
Clarence Thomas. Clarence Thomas.
Well, he voted against Clarence Thomas, but he also voted against Thurgood Marshall.
Oh.
So it's interesting, when you vote against a black Supreme Court judge in 1967, you're a conservative. But when you vote against a black Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas years later, you become a liberal. So who knows?
Since we last spoke, the president has gotten caught up in the classified document scandal of his own. I want to talk about that when we return. We'll take a quick break. Listeners, if you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest is political journalist Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Race might be a hot topic right now, but for so many of us, talking about race is nothing new. On the Code Switch podcast from NPR, we go beyond the headlines and we go deep. Listen now.
Welcome back to All Sides. We're talking national politics with my guest, political journalist Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. You can find a link to that at WOSU.org/allsides. So, Ken, as I said, President Biden has gotten caught up in the classified document scandal, and so has, we've got, we got Trump, we got Biden, Mike Pence.
We have Mike Pence, right?
It's just, it's a party.
Well, you know something, the thing is, it's very easy for Americans to be listening to these stories and saying, well, they're all doing it. This sounds like a Democratic, defensive Democrat. But the fact is that the Biden cases and the Trump cases are nothing alike. Trump said from the beginning that he didn't have documents and he wouldn't refuse, and he refused to respond to the Library of Congress's request to get them back, and refused and refused and refused. And that's what caused the FBI raid in Mar-a-Lago, and they came back with all these boxes of classified stuff. With Joe Biden, it was Joe Biden's people himself who found these classified documents, I think, in the office he was using after he left the vice presidency. And they contacted the White House counsel's office, and then they contacted the Library of Congress. But the archives, not the Library of Congress, but the National Archives. Mm-hmm. And so there's a difference there. However, trying to get information out of the Biden White House on when they first saw the documents and what took so long and how many documents were there. And of course, we've seen them in other places too. They found them in his Wilmington, Delaware home. I think they already searched his Rehoboth, Delaware beach house, and they didn't find anything there. But the thing is, it's clear that when you're reading the newspapers, you're watching the news, you're saying, well, why is Joe Biden, suppressing or keeping hidden or being very spare with information about these documents? And people say, well, they're all doing it. So, of course, because the Justice Department came up with a special counsel to investigate Trump, they had to do that with Biden, because it would look like it's just in the system was rigged if they didn't. So now Robert Hur is doing Mr. Smith goes to Washington to inspect this. And now the question is, well, now do we name a special prosecutor for Mike Pence? Now I think you're not anybody if you don't have secret documents, classified documents back in your home. I don't have anything, but my desk is such a mess. They may be.
There's the usual Democrats that are calling for an impeachment over this, blah, blah, blah. But cooler heads.
You mean Democrats, you mean Republicans.
I'm sorry, Republicans. Sorry. Cooler heads are prevailing among Republicans. Mitch McConnell says he's not interested. Senate Republicans, across the board have pretty much said they're not interested.
But Biden lost a big political advantage.
Yes,
because he was going around the country saying, what a disgrace Trump was, and he's lying about this, and what's wrong with him. And he did that during the 2022 campaign. He was talking about how Trump, just refused to turn back these documents, and now people saying, well, you did the same thing. But and of course, he didn't do the same thing. But I think the Democrats, and especially President Biden, squandered a huge opportunity to make political points. Not that everything in the world should be about politics, but
it seems like it is.
I wouldn't be on your show.
There's a big difference between what Biden did and what Trump did regarding the documents.
Absolutely.
But it takes too long to explain it. So
right,
that's the problem.
Perception is reality in politics. And the perception is that some people see no difference between Biden and Trump.
Charles in London, you're on the air. Hi, Charles.
Yes, I want to just comment on that real quickly. It's just a simple fact. The first rule of politics is get ahead of story, shape the narrative. And the Biden administration had 2 months to get ahead of that story and shape the narrative, and they abjectly failed, as he typically does. But the other thing they're failing at right now is that AOC, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, the squad, never had gavels. They were never part of Democratic leadership, but yet the Republican Party has labeled the entire Democratic Party, basically as the squad. And for some reason, the Democrats can't seem to do the same thing when Jim Jordan has a gavel. Marjorie Taylor Greene, like Ken was saying earlier, is in basically a position of influence. And then the other thing I want to see done is the fact that qualified immunity is not the linchpin to good to police reform. Oversight, transparency, and accountability is way more important than qualified immunity. And the reason why is because the police officers, once you commit a crime, these police officers are civilly liable. Qualified immunity only deals with circumstances where the offense by the law enforcement agency doesn't rise to the level of criminal culpability. So you can sue somebody for a lot of things that they weren't criminally culpable for. So the Democrats need to call the Republicans bluff, take qualified immunity off the board to get oversight, transparency, and accountability systems established. And to fail to do so, to me, they're giving the Republicans the easy out, because I know they'll find another excuse not to pass it. And you guys, thanks for taking my call. Have a great day.
All right. Thanks, Charles.
Wow. Well, you know something? I mean, I agree with everything Charles just said. You know, obviously, by saying that, I know that when my back is turned, you'll have him on the show instead of me. And I can live with that. I can understand that. But the fact is that Charles is exactly right. The Biden White House did not get ahead of the document story. Had they announced back in November that we found documents and we're dealing with it, you know, they could have gotten at least less suspicion on them, and so they lost with that. You're absolutely right. I mean, you know, the Republicans are absolutely calling the Democratic Party the squad, with, you know, Ilhan Omar and Rashid, you know, Tlaib and AOC. And of course, that's ridiculous, as Charles points out rightly, that they're not in leadership, whereas Marjorie Taylor Greene, Matt Gaetz, and Lauren Boebert, and Paul Gosar, and Jim Jordan, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, they're all in positions of influence. So, and the last thing he said was about accountability of the police. And, you know, one thing about this latest horrific, absolutely horrific murder by what we saw
in
Memphis police, mm-hmm. is that it's not necessarily about, I don't know if racism is the right word, but it's police brutality that has really been the issue, you know, driving while black, you know, that issue has been around forever. And while you think it's often with white cops and black victims, we're seeing that it can be black cops and black victims as well. So in other words, what Charles was saying about accountability is absolutely correct.
You're listening to All Sides.
One more thing. We were talking about the new video we saw, you know, the video of him being beaten, and the horrific reaction we all had to it. And then I was thinking of the violence of Paul Pelosi, the attack on Paul Pelosi in his San Francisco home.
What a weird.
Well, not only is it weird, the right-wing Republicans were coming up with theories and disgraceful theories that it was a love tryst that went bad. And I mean, so many awful, mm-hmm. pathetic things. And then you see this guy slam, you know, a hammer over the head of Paul Pelosi, the 82-year-old husband of Nancy Pelosi. And so many Republicans thought this was funny. This was a joke. And when you see the video, you say, my God, is this the depth of what political discourse has become in this country, but we can laugh at this? I mean, I don't remember any Democrats laughing at the shooting of Steve Scalise, mm-hmm. You know, during that baseball game, but somehow the hitting over a hammer on Paul Pelosi is you know, carte blanche for the Republicans to think this is, you know, lots of yucks.
Hey,
awful.
How did you, I'm curious, I want to talk about George Santos, but I'm also curious about how you think Nancy Pelosi has conducted herself as she steps back away from the limelight.
You know, there was a lot, you know, when Nancy Pelosi first took over, there were a lot of people, including Tim Ryan of Ohio, who felt that, you know, she was too liberal, too this, too old, too close to the establishment, and they wanted a change. By the time Nancy Pelosi left, I think it's fair to say that she has been one of the most amazingly powerful, competent, effective speakers in history, not female speaker. Well, of course, she's the only female speaker. Mm-hmm. But I mean, she has been absolutely incredible keeping her conference together. You know, voting for Obamacare really hurt the Democratic Party in the 2010 midterms, and yet she still kept the Democrats together, and yet they came back in 2018. She has done really something, and it's just remarkable. And yes, was it time for her to step down? Well, one, that the fact that the Democrats lost the House, although by a much smaller margin than anybody expected, but it was time for her to go. I mean, Nancy Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, you know, the Democratic leadership in Jim Clyburn of South Carolina, the Democratic leadership was in their 80s. And, you know, somebody has to tell the Democratic Party that is an 80-year-old Joe Biden the answer? You know, they're certainly in the House. They got a new generation of leadership. There are a lot of Democrats who are wondering maybe the same should be about the president himself. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, going back to Nancy Pelosi, an amazing job, an effective job, and she'll go down as history in history as one of the great speakers ever, you know, like Rayburn-ish. not Gene Rayburn, of course, but Sam Rayburn of Texas. Does anybody remember Gene Rayburn?
No.
Okay. I think he was the Match Game or something on.
Ring a bell. I can picture him in my mind. Representative George Santos of New York said that he would temporarily step away from his committee assignments, you know, amid this growing litany of questions about his background, his finances, his basic biography. I don't even know how old he is. And if he told me, I'm not sure I would believe him. The freshman member of the Republican caucus told the media that the break would allow him to, quote, take time to properly clear my name. His name. What are you thinking? The announcement came after he met privately with Speaker Kevin McCarthy. Do you think McCarthy had something to do with this? What are your thoughts?
Well, I think you got to give George Santos credit for winning the Super Bowl 3 years in a row. That was pretty remarkable. But here's my theory, and nobody's confirmed this, but I remain convinced that the reason that George Santos gave up those two committee assignments, which was a shame and a disgrace that he was named to committees anyway, you know, given the fact that Kevin McCarthy, was pulling Adam Schiff and Eric Swalwell off committees like the Intelligence Committee. But I think the reason he gave up his committees is that Kevin McCarthy clearly wants to strip Ilhan Omar of her assignment on the House Foreign Affairs Committee. And I think you had to get George Santos off committees for that to be more effectively argued. Because it's interesting, when the Democrats got rid of Marjorie Taylor Greene and Paul Gosar off committees, they did so because they were meeting with white nationalists and white supremacists. And they said, and then the Democrats said, that's unacceptable. And McCarthy at the time said that it's a disgrace for Congress to do that. And what a shock, lo and behold, now that he's in the power, McCarthy's doing the same thing by getting Schiff and Swalwell off the Intelligence Committee. And now he wants to get Ilhan Omar off the House of Foreign Affairs Committee. Look, there are a lot of people who don't like Ilhan Omar. She has been accused, and I think rightly so, of saying things that have been seen as anti-Semitic. Mm-hmm. She apologized every time, and every time she apologizes, she says something else that seems like a dog whistle to anti-Semites. But the fact is, I think that having George Santos, I mean, my God, I mean, he keeps saying, well, I'm not going to say anything because he was elected by the people back home in his Long Island district. Well, you know, that's ridiculous to say because he's getting rid of all the people who stand in his way, like Liz Cheney and others who he doesn't like. He never said, well, they were duly elected back home. But George Santos says, oh, I have nothing to do with this. It's up to them. But ultimately, I would be absolutely shocked if Santos is in Congress by the summer. Mm-hmm. Forget about the end of the year. The House Ethics Committee is looking into it, all his shenanigans. The Justice Department is looking into it. Everything he said about everything, it seems to be a lie. And I mean, look, if you got rid of every member of Congress because they lied, you'd have nobody left on Congress. And everybody knows that. But this is beyond the pale. Mm-hmm. And I just think he's not long for this job.
Vicky in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Vicky.
Yes, regarding George Santos. Mm-hmm. Had he been running as a Democrat, I think that the Republicans are aggressive enough that they would have found out all of this stuff and used it to make sure that the Democratic candidate, George Santos, lost and the Republican won. My problem is the Democrats don't play as dirty as the Republicans, and they should have done their own vetting of George Santos and brought it up. That's all I have to say.
All right. Thanks a lot, Vicky.
Vicky, I appreciate that. I'm glad you're not blaming the media, because everybody says, where was the media in this story? Well, the media is not going into 435 House districts.
Well, by the way, if it wasn't for local media, it wouldn't have broke at all.
Well, that's true. It was a Long Island
local media shout out there.
Break it at first. But Vicky is absolutely right. Where was the Democratic opposition research? I mean, the guy Zimmerman, Robert Zimmerman, who I think ran before years ago. But I mean, George Santos ran in 2020 and lost, 2022 and ran and won. And nobody was aware of his past, the Democratic opposition, you know. Well, first of all, I think probably one of the reasons is nobody expected Santos to win. I mean, this was a Democratic seat. He lost to a Democratic incumbent in 2020. The Democrats were favored to hold the seat last year, but they didn't. But the fact is, there was absolutely no Democratic opposition research. And I agree with Vicky that if it was the Republicans, they would have been going through, you know, their kindergarten records to make sure to see if there was anything afoul. So a big failure by the Democrats.
Yeah, it's just basic due diligence. And I'm thinking about, you know, as the only sport I played in high school was volleyball. And as a volleyball, former volleyball competitor.
Did you know George?
I did not. I just think it's interesting that he picked that sport.
Well, that was the reason, you know.
Because nobody pays attention.
What sport is Ann Fisher? Oh, yeah.
Well, he's lost the volleyball lobby. A Siena College poll found that 78% of the voters in his Long Island district want him to step down. But there's nothing they can do. They can't do a recall, right?
That's correct. The only thing that, first of all, and the Republican congressman in the adjoining districts also called for him to step down. So the Republicans back home want him out. It's just that it's Kevin McCarthy who needs the vote. He only has a vote of three or four. Like, for example, on the debt ceiling, if he loses, no, I'm sorry, on the Ilhan Omar, if he loses like four votes, because he wants her off the House Foreign Affairs Committee. If he loses three or four Republicans, it's over. So he needs every vote he can. But the only way to get rid of a congressman is two-thirds of a vote to expel them from Congress. And the last congressman who was expelled from Congress was everybody's favorite, James Traficant.
Ohio.
You know, the heir apparent of members of Congress. And yeah, he was kicked out in 2002 for corruption.
Yeah, well, the campaign finance issues here are pretty egregious, and still, I mean, kind of creepy what's coming out. I mean, there's a lot of questions.
You think? It's everything. It's almost like the Trump investigation, because right now, and it's not the same thing, of course, but right now Trump is being investigated not only on civil, but criminal charges. And not only the money he spent with Stormy Daniels, which he denied, and which, of course, on campaign finance forms, that is illegal, and the stuff he did to upend the democracy. So they're coming at George Santos from many different directions. It's amazing to me that he's standing up. Maybe McCarthy said, look, stay as long as you possible because I need your vote. That's very possible to me, too, because I think that could have been very well been part of the conversation he had with Kevin McCarthy when they met.
We're going to continue our conversation. My guest is political journalist Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. We're talking national politics. You have something you want to add? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Race might be a hot topic right now, but for so many of us, talking about race is nothing new. On the Code Switch podcast from NPR, we go beyond the headlines and we go deep. Listen now.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking national politics this hour. Still with us, veteran political journalist Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. We'll have a link to that at our website at wosu.org/allsides. You mentioned that there is a State of the Union address coming up. You said that nobody can remember what happened last time there was a State of the Union address, but what are you predicting will happen this time for those among us who actually watch that sort of thing?
Well, I predict that the Democrats will be losing a lot of weight by jumping up and down constantly applauding, and I think Republicans will sit on their hands. I don't know if you'll see any kind of outburst that we've seen before. I remember the first outburst was with Joe Wilson of South Carolina when he yelled out at Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. He said, "You lie," which mm-hmm. was pretty. I don't know if that was a State of the Union, but it was an address to Congress where I don't remember any dissension or any rowdyism coming from the crowd. But we do remember both Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert, you know, then best buds, yelling mm-hmm. at Biden last year. But, well, you know, something, I mean, look, I think what's interesting to me, and I say this not as an ageist, but I do want to see how Joe Biden looks and reacts. And yes, he is reading from a teleprompter, but this is the first time we're going to see an 80-year-old president. And I want to see how he handles himself you know, before the a tremendously large audience. It's probably the biggest audience he'll get before the election. Mm-hmm. And he has good things to talk about. I mean, you know, he talks about the, there have been 10 million jobs created. The millions and billions of dollars sent for pandemic relief, the infrastructure bill, the economy is certainly better than it was when he took office mm-hmm. in January of 2021. But as any American knows, inflation is still bad. You go into the food store and things cost a fortune. Energy cost a fortune. And we know what's going down on the border is not going well. And of course, there is the thing of gun violence around the country, which no president has seemed to be able to stop. Of course, some presidents care about getting guns off the streets more than others. But the fact is, it's a mixed record. Biden's numbers are under 50%. His approval ratings are under 50%. That's been the case for a long time. Mm-hmm. And so he's going to have to make a case, not that things have been great, and they haven't, and he knows it, but we're on the right track. That's the only thing a president can really do.
You wrote recently about how Democrats face an uphill battle in the Senate in 2024. You mentioned it a little bit earlier as well. Is it inevitable? It's just because of so many Democratic seats are up, right?
Not only. First of all, there are 34 seats up in next year, 23 of them held by Democrats, only 11 are held by Republican. But the fact is, none of the Republican seats look to be in any vulnerable state at all. I mean, Josh Hawley in Missouri is controversial, but Missouri is not going to elect a Democrat to the Senate. Those days are long over. But there are a lot of seats in among the Democrats that are very vulnerable. John Tester of Montana. We mentioned Joe Manchin in West Virginia. Mm-hmm. There's so many of those seats. We don't know. Sherrod Brown, my goodness. Sherrod Brown already has an opponent mm-hmm. For next year. There may be more. Mm-hmm. Sherrod Brown is popular. He's the only Democrat who seems to win in Ohio. But my goodness, Ohio is just not the Ohio when he was first elected to Congress. It's not the same Ohio. It's much more conservative, much more Trumpian. I mean, already J.D. Vance has endorsed Donald Trump for 2024. It just shows how where the Republican Party is in Ohio in 2024. So it's going to be tough for the Democrats to hold on to the Senate. Predicting 2 years in advance or a year and a half in advance, I should not be doing that. I should know better. But I can't see how the Democrats can possibly keep the Senate next year.
They're really going to have to raise a ton of money. I mean, an absolute ton of money. They're saying that it could be a record breaker for whoever Sherrod Brown runs
every,
again.
You know something? Every cycle, they break the records.
Yeah.
Say, oh, we've never had this before. I remember when in 2000, when Adam Schiff first ran for Congress and beat Congressman Jim Rogan, who was a big advocate of Clinton's impeachment, that was the most expensive House race in history. And that was 22 years ago. And now that is, you know, those numbers have been dwarfed by every election since. So we just spend a fortune and we raise a fortune. And of course, the Citizens United court decision allows unlimited spending from a lot of these campaigns.
Yeah, I was reading Jimmy Carter's last memoir, and when he talks about how he and Jerry Ford agreed not to be publicly use just public funds to not raise money for the presidential election that year. I mean, that's just almost quaint.
Well, even better, you know, I was reading this the other day because I'm fascinated by Eugene McCarthy and his challenge to Lyndon Johnson. But Eugene McCarthy, everybody thinks of as running a shoestring campaign, you know, get clean with Gene. But he had backers who gave him money by the millions that were not reported because, and look, we know what the Kennedys could spend as well. So unreported money was always the way to be. Somehow Congress, by having public financing, was supposed to fix all these things. And, you know, Mitch McConnell, of course, being the biggest advocate of just free spending, you know, the mother's milk of politics is money. There's no limits at all. Anything goes. And the only thing good about that, and in my view, is that they make more campaign buttons. And if they keep doing that, I think that's a good thing for America, personally.
Dianne Feinstein.
Dianne Feinstein. She's 89 years old.
Look,
but so is Chuck Grassley, and he was just reelected last year. But Dianne Feinstein's faculties have been leaving her. She's not, her mental, abilities have been on a clear decline, and Democrats as well as Republicans acknowledge that. Nobody in the world thinks she's going to run again, but she hasn't announced anything yet. And that's why members of Congress are already running. Katie Porter announced a couple of weeks ago. Last week, Adam Schiff. I mean, I don't know if Adam Schiff would have run had Kevin McCarthy kicked him off the Intelligence Committee, but clearly Adam Schiff is not going to enjoy being in the House with no power anymore. And he was very close with Nancy Pelosi, who is not a power anymore either. So maybe it's time for him to get out of the House. And Barbara Lee, African-American, has told members of the Black Caucus that she too is planning to run, although she has far less money. Ro Khanna, who's a very left-wing Democratic congressman, very close with Bernie Sanders' wing of the party. He's also planning to run. It's going to be a free-for-all. And no Republican need apply. There's no way a Republican can win that seat. Plus the fact that California has this very unique, not very unique. You can't say very with the word unique. It's unique.
Yes.
That's very unique. They have this very unique plan, election plan that all the candidates run on the same ballot and the top two finishers, regardless of party, move on to the November election. So I suspect it'll be two Democrats running against each other in November of 24. Fascinating race to watch, but no question about what party's going to win it.
I'm interested in what your thoughts are about the House Democratic leader, Representative Hakeem Jeffries of New York, the first African-American Congressional Party leader in U.S. history.
Well, it's a big generational change from Nancy Pelosi, clearly. He's not Nancy Pelosi, but of course he's not expected to be. Now, of course, Nancy Pelosi made history by being the first female speaker. Hakeem Jeffries is the first African-American speaker. He has a long way to go. And of course, being in the minority is, you know, you can't really get a sense of what he can do in trying to keep his troops together. But, you know, who knows if the McCarthy Republicans are seen as too right wing, too conservative. And then 2 years, it's very possible that the Democrats could win back the House. Or if Joe Biden's numbers are so horrific and they continue to get worse, then, you know, maybe the Democrats won't win the House. You know, there's a lot to see what's going to happen. But I think that the book is still out on Hakeem Jeffries.
Okay. What you know, what are you looking at right now? What are you, what kind of questions are you asking about national politics right now?
Well, you know, the big headline this week was that Nikki Haley, the former mm-hmm. governor of South Carolina, former U.S. ambassador to the U.N., is going to announce her presidential candidacy on February 15th. And that's very interesting to me because, look, Donald Trump is the only Republican, well, I guess, and only Republican who has announced his candidacy so far. And I think the sense was for the Republicans to sit back and see if he has any legs because, mm-hmm. you know, they loved him in 2016, they loved him in 2020. But between, you know, the January 6th stuff and his railing about I really won the election when he really lost and mm-hmm. having dinner with Kanye West and Nick Fuentes and all these controversial things that he's done. And he's also 76 years old, which, of course, if you're Joe Biden, he's a youngster. But I mean, 76 is an old guy. And a lot of Republicans say, well, Ron DeSantis is only in his 40s. So I think a lot of Republicans are staying back waiting to see what Trump does.
What do you think about Nikki Haley as a running mate?
Well, I thought of that, too. And it seems like, first of all, it's almost not fair to not because she's a woman, but because everybody seems to say that it's either Trump or DeSantis or nobody else. The problem with Nikki Haley as a running mate is, one, she has been very critical of Trump in recent years, you know, talking about what he said, what he did on January 6th, which is unacceptable. And I expect that anybody who gets in Trump's way, could be attacked over and over again. And we'll see what Trump has to say about Nikki Haley. And she wouldn't really be Ron DeSantis's running mate either, because she comes from nearby South Carolina, which, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, of course, there was Clinton and Gore, which everybody said, well, they were too close to each other, age-wise, temperament, and geographically, but they turned out to be a good team. I don't see her being a running mate, but let's give her credit. She's running for president. She's not running for vice president, but there are a lot of people running for vice president. Glenn Youngkin of the governor of Virginia, maybe Tim Scott also. That's fascinating what's going on in South Carolina. Henry McMaster, the governor, mm-hmm. and Lindsey Graham, the senator, have already endorsed Donald Trump. Nikki Haley's announcing, the former governor of South Carolina is announcing on February 15th. And Tim Scott, the other senator, is going to be in Iowa soon, possibly campaigning. So I'd love to find somebody in South Carolina who's not running for president.
What is going on with Ron DeSantis? Speaking of somebody who might run for president, he wants to block diversity, equity, and inclusion programs.
He wants to get rid of AP, advancement placement courses in high school about African American history, because he's saying it's indoctrinating people. And he said, well, you know, I saw one on the curriculum, something about queer history. I mean, he always finds things to attack, like whenever an African American is caught voting twice or, you know, illegally voting, he throws the book at him. But if it's a white person who votes twice, they give him the minimum sentence. So he's very controversial. He's very in your face. He's almost like Trump without the baggage. Although, polls, it'll be interesting to see what happens, because there are a lot of Republicans that it's time to look elsewhere other than Trump. But if I had to predict, I wouldn't, because I don't know how anybody could stop Trump. I mean, even if he only has, let's say, 40% of the Republican vote, and there are four or five Republicans running against him in the primaries and caucuses, well, Trump wins, you know, as he did in 2016 when 5 or 6 or 13 other Republicans also ran.
I'm just wondering about the long-term viability of his attitude about diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, and how people are going to view the state of Florida if those are banned in the universities.
I agree with you. Remember, after Mitt Romney lost in 2012, the Republicans came up with this autopsy saying, look, if we don't realize that there were changing demographics in this mm-hmm. country, we can forget about ever winning again. Well, Donald Trump said, the heck with, demographics. I'm going to get my base out. And perhaps that's what DeSantis says, too. But, African-Americans in Florida represent a huge percentage of the vote. And, of course, it didn't matter last year when DeSantis won by a record margin of any Republican in state history, when he won, was reelected governor by 19 percentage points. But at some point, it's going to have to bite you in the behind. Somehow, it's going to have to say, look, you can't run for president against people, against a certain kind of people. Mm-hmm. And if his answer, if Ron DeSantis' answer is, voter suppression, AP courses in African-American history, somehow there are Republicans out there saying, this is not what my party stands for.
Ken Rudin, political journalist, host of the Political Junkie podcast. Thanks, as always. It was good to see you.
And I love being on your show. Thank you.
Thank you. That's it for now. Thanks to everybody else out there listening in radio land and podcast land, however you're listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.